We've got a special guest joining the podcast today, but before we get to that, we need to talk how the league treats their star players and greatness. Those two very thematic topics that have come up over the last little bit. We'll cover those and then get into our special guest, Mr. Alex Hobson of the Hockey Writers for the Toronto Maple Leafs, here on episode 128 of the Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast. Let's go. It is an absolutely beautiful day today. Springtime, starting to get more of a feel for it. Playoff hockey around the corner. Tuesday, April the 12th, the Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast. Make sure you follow along on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor.com, wherever you get your podcasts, really. Online at ST Hockey Podcast, Instagram, and Twitter. Now, we're going to have a special guest, Alex Hobson, today from the Hockey Writers. He's also a morning show producer over in Niagara. He's also the co-host of Sticks in the Six. Before we get to him, because he covers the Toronto Maple Leafs, so we're going to be covering all the, you know, the Leaf stuff in there. Couple tidbits I want to get over. The template of the show today is going to be a little bit different because of him. So we had a chance to sit down and chat earlier. I just want to go over a couple things that I saw from around the league. Really just two things in particular here. And the first thing I want to start off with, and it's a topic that I've brought up on the show before, and we're getting right into it. We're like a minute and a half in. We're getting right into it. Enjoy greatness. Why did it become so hard to just enjoy greatness? Never have I seen fans or people disregard greatness the way that I've seen in the NHL. Tom Brady winning 7 Super Bowls. I know that there are people that don't like it, but there's a whole lot of people that like, listen, you got to respect the fact that this dude's won 7. LeBron James in the NBA. Guys, 4-time world champion, MVPs, records being broken by Steph Curry. People go nuts. Why are we harshing on the greatness that we are seeing in the National Hockey League? There is so many people shooting their glasses up, coming in with these little numbers, saying that Austin Matthews 50 goals or 51 goals in 50 games doesn't technically count because it didn't start at the beginning of the season. So these main contributors, these main sites like Sportsnet, TSN, and the goddamn National Hockey League have to put in these stupid quotations. Austin Matthews has scored 51 in his last 50 games, not at the beginning of the season, as if 51 and 50 isn't as clear as day to everybody on planet friggin' Earth. Can we just enjoy it? When did just enjoy greatness become such a goddamn hard task to understand? Why is it so difficult? I was talking to a buddy. Leafs played the Habs on Saturday. Leafs won 3-2. Cole Caulfield scored in his 4th straight game. I was like, oh my God, this Cole Caulfield kid's sick. Like, he's figuring it out. And he has like 18 goals this season. I'm recognizing this kid could be great. Like, he could be really, really good. And I'm seeing people be like, Austin Matthews isn't even that. It's not even that impressive. It's not even in the first. Can we just enjoy the fact that this dude has 58 goals on the season? I saw Leaf fans being like, to put it in perspective, Gretzky, 50-39. Lemieux, 50 and whatever. Matthews, 50-67. First of all, he's got 58. And second of all, that's not the topic of conversation. The dude has 51 goals in his last 50 games played. His last 50 games played. Not the games that you're counting. Well, his 50th was an empty netter. So was Gretzky's 50th goal in his 39th game to set the goddamn record. I don't understand what is so difficult to just enjoy greatness. People are cheering on the fact Steph Curry breaks the all-time three-point record. He did it when he was by like 32, which is nuts. people, you know, it did get a little bit of hate, but people love the fact Aaron Rodgers, first back-to-back MVP. People, like, they enjoy greatness. Matthews is going to be the only player this season to hit 60 goals, and the first time it's been done in 13 years. And there's going to be these statisticians and analytics people that have never played the goddamn game of hockey that are coming in. Well, 12 of them come with a power play and 4 of them have been empty netters. Oh my God, shut up. Shut up. Enjoy the fact that this dude has 58 goals. He's also played in like 6 less games than the next closest guy who's 8 goals back. And then it's 9 goals back. They're not going goal for goal anymore. The dude has taken off. We lost it last year. Lost it. Everyone loved the fact. Connor McDavid, 100 points in 56 games. The league went nuts. McDavid and Draisaitl, 200-point players in a shortened season. Oh my God. Everyone lost it. Everyone loved it. Everyone thought it was amazing. And it was. It was great for the game. I came on here. I'm like, I could not believe for a second that in a 56-game season, we would have a 100-point getter. Not a chance in the world. 2 of them on the same team. It's incredible. And Matthews gets 51 goals in his last 50 games. And I cannot believe the discredit. I've never seen a fan base of a sport want their sport to fail and to patronize their superstars more than the National Hockey League. I've never seen it in my life. Enjoy greatness. Enjoy the fact that this dude could literally potentially be a 60-goal perennial scorer for at least the next few years. He's 24 years old. No one's even talking about the fact that he should have hit 50 for the 3rd straight year in a row. But he's had 2 shortened seasons due to a pandemic. And he won the Rocket last year in like 56 games. He had 40-something goals. Enjoy when a player is great and making the game better. By the way, in 4 games last week, Matthews had 7 goals and 11 points. He set the Toronto Maple Leafs all-time record for goals. He was the first player to score 50 goals in 50 games in any stretch of the season since Mario Lemieux almost 20 years ago, and he broke the record for most goals scored in a season by an American player. Can we just enjoy greatness? Please, I'm begging you. I don't even care if you're not a Leaf fan. Everyone loving the fact. Tampa Bay, bubble season, Stanley Cup winner, no fans in the building, no asterisk. No asterisk. Back-to-back cup winners. Shortened season. There's no asterisk on it. I haven't heard anyone say anything about it. Everyone. No, Tampa could go three-peat. Tampa's a juggernaut. And they are. Why is there an asterisk on this? Well, he didn't do it in his first 50 games. Who friggin' cares? Enjoy greatness. I'm begging you. Enjoy greatness, because it might not happen again. Matthews might never hit 60 again. Right? Stamkos hit 60. Everyone was like, he's going to do it every single year. He hasn't done it since. Ovi, 65 one year. Everyone was like, oh my God, he's going to do it every single year. He hasn't done it since. I don't know if Matthews is ever going to do this again. I have no idea. Enjoy it. Just please enjoy greatness. I'm begging you. I'm begging you, please. If you're really nitpicking the fact that Matthews' 51 goals didn't come at the beginning of the season and, in fact, didn't come in 50 games, it really goes to tell you how incredible the season it is, because your discreditation is he's actually only scored 58 goals in 67 games. Like, wow. So if you do the goal per game average, if you take the numbers into account for it, 58 goals in 67 games, right? That's the number. If he scored a goal for every single game he's played in, he will have only gone 9 games without scoring a goal. Out of 67 games, if that's the math you're going to go with, Because you can make up your own math. I can make up my own math. If you're actually saying, no, he's actually only scored 50 in 67, but it's 58 in 67 if we're including every effing game. If you average out Matthews' goal per game over the course of 67 games, he has 58 goals, which would mean that if he scored just one goal per game and then it spread out, he has only got 9 games out of 67 without a goal. So if I pull my calculator out and just throw this quick math, and if I do 58 divided by 67, that means he has scored a goal in 86.5% of the games he's played in. If that's what we're doing, if we're allowed to make up math now, and finite and fixture on the smallest little details that actually don't matter. See what I'm doing right here? That's what everyone else is doing out there who's saying that the 51 goals in 50 games don't count because they wasn't at the beginning of the season. All right, so math is made up now. Math is English. Math is theory. Enjoy greatness. I'm begging you. Enjoy greatness when you see it because it might not happen again. Next thing I want to get onto. A couple games ago, Genny Malkin. Cross-checks defenseman from the Nashville Predators, Mark Borowiecki. There was a hearing. He got suspended 4 games for it. Similarly to the greatness take, I've also never seen a league penalize their star players more than the NHL. Of the two more notable cross-checks in the head, and we've seen a dozen since the one that Matthews did in Buffalo that got a big uproar. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is the only other one. And we've seen in between everything, sucker punches, slew foots, knee on knees, you name it, hits from behind. The only two players to get suspensions from things like this. I'm sorry, I think there was one other player. I think it was Casey Cizikas from the Islanders who got less than both these guys. If Genny Malkin gets 4 games, Matthews gets 2. It's either Casey Cizikas or one of the fourth line guys from the Islanders got a game. You want to know why the NHL is 5th in most popular sports or like the highest grossing or whatever the number is, but they're not even in the top 4 anymore in national sports. They don't crack the top 4. Because they punish their stars. The NBA, the NFL market their stars. Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, they use them to their advantage because kids watch them and grow up wanting to be them. The NBA, everybody now shoots the 3 ball. So the NBA marketed the hell out of Steph Curry. The new face of the NBA, can he rival King James? They met in the finals the next 4 seasons in a row. And the NBA skyrocketed. The WWE, for God's sakes. WrestleMania, I don't know if you saw this. WrestleMania was the highest viewed sporting event of the entire year. More than the Super Bowl. Had more streaming hours. Had more live viewers. Because they market. They bring special guests on. They enhance their superstars. I understand if your thoughts and processes around wrestling aren't necessarily there, but you understand what I mean? The WWE is global. The NFL is global. The NBA is global. The NHL is not. I guarantee you, if you go over to somewhere in Europe, there's probably people in the States. If you walk to them and say, do you know who Austin Matthews is? They will not know. If you go, hey, do you know who Connor McDavid is? They probably tell you who? The league sucks at marketing their players and prioritizing them. The NFL has literally changed the rules so that you cannot hit the quarterback. You have to hit them head on in the chest cleanly. You cannot land on them. The game has never thrived better. Say what you want about the NFL getting softer because you're not allowed to actually hit anymore. They've lessened the amount of head injuries, traumas, concussions. They've upped their viewership. Their cap continues to skyrocket. Receivers make $30 million a year now. There is a receiver who may be in the top 50 receivers in the NFL. His name's Christian Kirk. He just signed, it's like a 3 or 4 year deal with the Jacksonville Jaguars. The Jacksonville Jaguars are like the Arizona Coyotes of football. They signed a guy, a receiver, not even the most important position, to a year that's going to pay him $20 million a season. He might not even crack the top 50 receivers in the NFL. He probably will, but top 50. He makes $7.5 million per year more than McDavid. Arguably the greatest player we have ever seen. One of the most skilled and insanely athletic hockey players in the history of our sport is making $7.5 million less than maybe a top 50 receiver. Receivers not even in the top three most important positions in football. The most important positions in football go quarterback, tackle, edge rusher, then you could argue safety, receiver. There is a random receiver out there named Christian Kirk. He's a good receiver, but top 50 maybe, who makes more money than Connor McDavid. Because the league doesn't punish their stars. They punish you if you do something really bad. But this league has just overlooked cross-check after knee, after sucker punch, after God knows what, and the superstars that retaliate back because they take so much shit. Sorry I had to swear there. But they take so much abuse, and when they finally retaliate, when they finally say enough's enough, I'm going to give a shot back, they get penalized. They get fined for it. You want to know why the league is fifth in overall national sports? The baseline for Evgeny Malkin was Austin Matthews. 2 games. Why did you give him 4? Am I okay with the fact that he got suspended? Yes, because the precedent was set by Austin Matthews. But we've seen other not as important players get away with cross checks to the head, slew foots, kneeing, sucker punches. Maybe a fine of 5K, 5 grand. You want to fine a guy up it to 50 grand. It'll make a statement. Suspend the guys that do this regularly. All you're doing is saying, oh, you're allowed to hit the superstar because when the superstar hits you back, they're the ones that get in trouble. That's my thought on it. I could be totally off base with this, but I saw it and I went, 4 games. That seems like a lot. And it was a little shot. Matthews was worse. 100% was worse. I still don't think it was suspendable based on other events that I saw take place that have gotten away with. You can sucker punch a guy in the face from behind without him looking. You will not get suspended for it. But after you take 3 cross checks, if you cross check back once, you will be suspended 2 games. And Matt Borowiecki did the same thing. He kept hitting Malkin. Malkin turned around, gave him a little whack. That was fine. Gave him a cross check in the head. 4 games. I don't know anymore. I don't know anymore. Anyways, that's my rant. That's all the things I'm going to talk about today because we have got a special guest on the podcast. Alex Hobson, who has been a writer for the Hockey Writers for the last couple of seasons covering the Toronto Maple Leafs. He also used to cover the Colorado Avalanche. He's the co-host of Six in the Six podcast. He is the producer of News Talk 610 in Niagara. And I got a chance to sit down and chat with him and chat all Toronto Maple Leafs. So I know a lot of Leaf fans listen. We had a great chat. Hope you enjoy it. Second Thoughts Hockey Podcast, episode 128. And listen, it's been a minute since I've had a guest on the program, and I'm really excited here. We have got from the Hockey Writers. He is also the co-host of Sticks in the Six podcast, Alex Hobson. Thank you so much, by the way, for coming on and chatting with me today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for inviting me. It's fun. It's cool to finally meet you face to face, sort of. I know.
Yeah, I know.
Really face to face, I guess, but putting a face to the name.
Yeah, because we both cover teams for the Hockey Writers, which you should go check out our recent pieces. Just want to point that out there, hockeywriters.com. But Alex, you cover the Toronto Maple Leafs, and for the majority of the year, a lot of content that we share here, the Leafs have always gotten a ton of coverage, a ton of clicks, ton of likes. There's always talk going about the team. And I feel like this was a really good time to bring you on too, because of, you know, where the team lies right now. I want to start because I know you've been very well in on it. Like, you are as active on Twitter as I've seen, which is fantastic, because like, you're the guy I follow for a lot of things. So Matthews 58 so far. He's got a chance to get to 60. They play Buffalo on Tuesday. And then they've got games, I think, later on in the week. They play, is it Ottawa? I think they go Washington on Thursday or something like that.
Yep. Yeah, Washington Thursday. I'm not sure who they play on Saturday, but I know it's Buffalo tomorrow for sure. So pencil that in for a loss.
Seriously, it's just the way that the franchise has gone. The season that Matthews is having, I know that's being talked about a lot and it's being hyped up, especially by the Toronto media, but is it deservedly so? Because in the 100-plus year franchise of the Toronto Maple Leafs, we've never seen this before. The last time we had a 60 goal score was 13 years ago or 12 years ago with Steven Stamkos. So is it getting the hype that it deserves? Because it's quite a feat.
Oh, absolutely. I think that anytime you've got a 50 goal scorer, you should be talking about it. I think that's an incredible feat that, you know, maybe Ovechkin and guys like that in recent years have sort of normalized, but I think people have kind of forgotten how hard it is to score 50 goals in a season. So, and then on top of that, you know, being in Toronto, obviously you're going to have these headlines that are sort of blowing every single situation out that and making it out to be even more than it might be. But I don't think that's the case for Matthews scoring 50. I think it's one of those things where you're going to get double the coverage on it because it's a hell of a feat. And, you know, Leafs haven't had a 50 goal score since Rick Vive. It's been a really, really long time. Most of these new generational fans have never seen a player like Matthews and a player of his caliber. And, you know, the part that always gets me is I'm seeing all this discourse because he obviously just scored his 50th goal in his last 50 games. And, you know, there's all this discourse on Twitter about whether or not it was a legitimate 50 and 50 or what. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, like if the debate we're having right now is how legit his 50 goals in his past 50 games were, then that should tell you a lot about how good of a hockey player he is. Like if you asked me, say 10 years ago, or if you told me 10 years ago, rather, that I'd have the opportunity to watch a number one center score 50 goals for my favorite hockey team, let alone in 50 games, at that time, I think it was Phil Kessel was probably the closest thing. And he was only a 30-40 goal scorer. So yeah, to answer your question, yes, I do think it's getting the coverage and it deserves the coverage that it's getting right now, because we haven't seen this in Toronto for a long time. You said it best, and hell, like he's on pace to score 60 goals and we haven't seen that since Stamkos. So yeah, I'm here for all the coverage. Obviously I'm a Leaf fan, so that's easy for me to say, but yes, I do think it's getting the coverage it deserves.
Well, 29 years between the last time this happened, which was Mario Lemieux and the Pittsburgh Penguins. Now, he did it in, I believe, a shorter time frame, but nevertheless, I remember when there was the dead puck era and like when they really wanted to try and limit the amount of goals, the early and mid 2000s when scoring was at a real low. And I remember when Alexander Ovechkin was hitting those 50 goal marks and we were all sitting here be like, this is not supposed to happen. And slowly but surely, we've kind of grown a little bit. And there's those very select few players that I think can hit it now. I think Ovechkin's there. Stamkos has done it recently. Draisaitl over in Edmonton. And I think Austin Matthews has now become a legitimate, you know, he's going to be doing this for a while. And then also to mention, he could have done this for the last three seasons had there not been shortened due to COVID and lockout and everything like that. So this could have been a conversation we had 3 years ago. And I feel like this has just been a prolonged inevitability.
More or less. Yeah. I mean, you hit the nail on the head pretty hard. I mean, 2019-20 was the season that COVID postponed. And I believe he was on track to hit 50 goals that season. Obviously it got cut off because of the shutdown. And then obviously you look at 2021 and I mean, I think it would have been amazing if he scored 50 goals in 56 games, but I think at the time, maybe that would have been a lot to ask of him. But now that we're seeing him do it and we're seeing him, you know, on track for 60 goals and perhaps even 70 goals. I mean, I don't know. I think that might be a little excessive, but 12 goals in the next 15 games. I mean, this guy scored 2 goals in each of his last 2 games. So it's not really that far out of the realm of possibility, at least not compared to where it may have been at the start of the season. So, yeah, he's definitely been on track to do it a couple of times. And I think you make a good point when you say that this might be the norm for him, because, you know, he's only what, 24 years old at this point. He's players normally don't hit their prime until they're 27, 28, 29. So the fact that he's been able to do this and he's been on pace to do it for the past couple of years, I think we're really only scratching the surface of what he might become as a hockey player in Toronto.
God, that's terrifying to think that there's a chance he gets better. Like, as if, because every year so far, he has improved his game, and you're seeing it now with the point totals. Before, I remember his rookie year, he hit the 40 goal mark on the empty netter, and everyone was kind of freaking out. And even that year, he was around the point per game mark, but he was at about like 60 something points because his assists were a little lower. But now he's kind of garnering up there, and now he's a point away from 100, which is also a very underrated feat that he's going to hit this season. And I want to transition over from that because it is remarkable. And I feel like 100 points is especially now becoming more normal. And I feel like it's not as impactful for the Hart Trophy, because we've seen McDavid, Draisaitl, Gaudreau's going to hit it. Kachuk has a chance to hit it. Huberto's already hit it. I feel like the 100 point plateau nowadays, especially for the Hart Trophy, is not as significant as 60 goals would be. And I feel like that's where Matthews kind of has the edge in the Hart race, in my opinion. McDavid's right up there. I know Huberto's going to be there. People are kind of throwing Shesterkin in there, but I feel like he's more of a lock for the Vezina, but even that's now debatable. Do you agree in that sense that if he hits 60 goals, call the Hart, like it's done?
Yeah, I would probably agree with that at this point. I mean, I was a pretty big advocate for Shesterkin being considered for it. And having said that, I think Shesterkin's rough march, I think, is going to come back and sort of play against him when it comes to time to vote for the Hart winner. Huberto's obviously an option as well. He's having a great season for Florida, but truth be told, like you said, 60 goals, especially playing in a market like Toronto. And when you consider the fact that these 50 goals, like they're coming towards the end of the season. And I saw someone make a really good point about this the other day, saying that you can say all you want, yeah, he didn't score 50 in his first 50. Back to the whole legitimacy of what a 50 and 50
really
means.
Such a stupid argument.
It is. That's why I'm saying, like, if we're sitting here arguing how legit a 50 goal season is, then like what are we doing, right? So anyways, going back to the start of the season, I mean, I personally think, and you know, this will obviously sound like I'm being biased because I am a Leafs fan, but down the stretch, I would think it's harder to score 50 goals than it is to score 50 goals at the start of the season. Down the stretch, when the teams in your division, especially, you know, in Toronto's case, who Florida's stacking up, Tampa's stacking up, Boston's stacking up, teams are really starting to tighten up, and you can feel the pace of games start to pick up as well. Like, there have been a couple of Leaf games, those games against Boston and Tampa Bay, they felt like playoff games all the way. So I think it's harder hockey to play right now. And you know, you can say all you want about what the Leafs record is without Austin Matthews. You know, they do have a pretty solid record when he's not playing. And I guess that kind of defeats the purpose of most valuable per se. But at the same time, I think every time Matthews has been out of the lineup, the sample size has been a little too small to really gauge where the Leafs would be without him. Because, you know, if he's out for one game or two games for that, say, for example, that suspension, that the cross check on Dahlin's face, you know, he misses two games there, and the team's like, okay, we really got to step up and play well while our number one center's out. And they can go ahead and do that. They've got the pieces beyond Matthews to win hockey games, but we haven't seen what this Leafs team is like without Matthews for a prolonged period of time. And I don't think that if you were to take Matthews out of the lineup for 20 to 25 games or something like that, I don't think the Leafs record would be as good as it is right now without him. So I think, as of right now, he is the only player on the Leafs who I firmly believe can put a game on his back and change the complexion of it single-handedly. He's the only guy I think who can go out there and, you know, decide when he wants to score and decide, decide when to give his team a momentum boost. He's the only guy on the team I really have faith in putting a game on his back and taking matters into his own hands. So in that regard, yes, I think that he's probably the MVP if he hits 60. I think he's definitely the MVP if he hits 60 goals. Enough beating around the bush. He is.
I was going to say he's got two goals to do it in 10 games now, which if you look at his pace is laughable. Which, if you told me at the beginning of the season that he was locked to score 60 goals before the 73 game mark, I'd call you nuts, because that's an insane pace. there's one guy that I think is, he's slowly starting to get a little bit more recognition, but it took a while, really until I would say the month of January. The guy who is actually leading the league in points since January, that's Mitch Marner. And for a long time, he has been the one of the sole, you know, individuals of criticism, whether it's to do with money, whether it's to do with playoff collapses, whatever the case may be. The pace that he's on now, and maybe it has to do with the pairing of Austin Matthews. Do you think that, you know, now Marner's season is kind of going a little bit more underrated because of A, what Matthews is doing, and B, because of guys like Huberdeau and McDavid and everybody and hitting that 100-point plateau? Do you feel like Marner's kind of going under the radar a little bit?
I would say Marner was going under the radar probably up until that stretch of games a week or two ago when they played Tampa Bay and Boston. I think in those games when the Leafs really got tested against teams that were they're fighting for, you know, home ice advantage, or fighting for home ice advantage against, and fighting for, you know, seeding against. I think once those games came around and Matt and Marner stepped up the way that, you know, I think the Leafs wanted him to, I think that at that point, he wasn't underrated anymore. I think everyone kind of realized, okay, this guy is having an unbelievable season. But yeah, before that, I absolutely think that he was flying under the radar. I mean, he's got what, something like, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's 60 something points in like 35 games.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. That's like, he's scoring at pretty much over 2 points per game. And, you know, Matthews, like you said, he is getting a lot of the spotlight because he's, you know, he's setting a record here. He's breaking a record here. He's scoring goals. He's in the media. He's in the middle of the spotlight, the media spotlight 24/7. So he is getting most of the attention. And I think Marner, in that regard, is probably getting less. But I think, like I said, once him and Matthews both kind of went off during that stint when they were playing all these playoff teams in the Atlantic, I think at that point, Mitch Marner's started to get the recognition that he deserved for the way that he's been playing. And then when you take into consideration his impact on the penalty kill as well, and his play all over the ice, he has really taken taken his game to a different level this year. And I think on top of that, you can even look at his physicality. He led the team in hits the other night.
Like, he was second to Lyubushkin. Lyubushkin had 10, Marner had 7 on Saturday.
Yeah, sorry. Led Leafs forwards in hit. My bad. But
it was nuts. Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
It's hilarious. Yeah, you look, because, you know, the number one token argument for guys like Marner is that he's too soft and doesn't have heart and he doesn't care or whatever. At this point, if you're saying that, you're not watching the games. I'm sorry. But yeah, I do think that at this point, he's starting to get the recognition that he deserves, because the pace he's been on is torrid. And, you know, especially considering he went the entire month of October only recording 1 point. And then he had to catch up after that. That missed the COVID outbreak and everything. He also missed time with an injury too. Remember when he collided with Jake Muzzin in practice and he had to miss like a month of action or something like that. Granted, I don't know if it was actually a month. I think the COVID pause kind of tampered with that a little bit, but either way, he missed time with an injury. He missed time. He may as well have missed time at the start of the year because he was invisible, and now look at him. So yeah, I do think that while he was underrated at this point, I think he's probably getting a good amount of recognition for how he's played.
In 63 games, he is somehow top 6 in scoring, despite missing nearly 10, which is it. That's mind blowing to me. And yeah, this stretch he's had over the last little bit has been incredible. I want to move on to some of the players that have been acquired over the course of the season, and not just the Giordano and the Blackwell. I think arguably the biggest impact player that this team has received and has traded for has been Ilya Lyubushkin. I have been, the moment that he came and what he did, he didn't change his game. He magically was paired with Morgan Riley, which is one of the weirdestly best like combinations of players, for Riley's ability to go up offensively and for Lyubushkin's physicality and simplicity. Do you agree with that? And like, and that's over guys like Giordano and Blackwell and even the guys they signed. I know Michael Bunting's, but I just think Lyubushkin has stabilized and set a tone and presence on the back end.
Yeah, I think I'm going to need to see probably some more games out of Giordano and Blackwell before I really compare them to Lyubushkin. But I think you're definitely onto something, saying that his impact has been good enough and it's been big enough that you can put him in the conversation with guys like Giordano and Blackwell in terms of deadline acquisitions, English, who have made impacts for the Leafs. I mean, you know, and you saw it just the other night against Florida when Sheldon Keefe took him out of the lineup in favor of Justin Hall, which was, in my opinion, one of the dumbest decisions I think Keefe's ever made as a head coach.
Yeah, I'm going to have that coming up in a second. Mm-hmm.
And I am on record right now. I'll say I am one of the biggest Sheldon Keefe truthers out there. I think he's the perfect coach for this team right now. I still criticize him when he makes moves that I disagree with. And that was one of them, especially for a team like the Florida Panthers, who are notoriously heavy in front of the net. And they score a shit ton of goals. And hell, you even look at the game on against Florida and how many of their goals, besides that stupid shorthanded slap shot from Ratko Gudas, how many of those goals were tap-ins in front of the net?
I think it was like five. It was five of them, which was nuts. Mm-hmm.
And just for that reason alone, you can see how much more the Leafs D-Corps struggles without Lyubushkin there. And you know what? I don't care if Lyubushkin doesn't score a single goal this season. I don't care if he finishes without a single point. All I care is that he shows up and he does what he's paid to do, which is box guys out in front of the net, use his body. That's because, you know, I will also go out on a limb and say that Morgan Rielly, his defensive game, or not his defensive game, I should say, but his offense almost seems to have taken another gear playing with Lyubushkin as well, because you're giving him a guy who, you know, when Morgan Riley's out on the ice at 5-on-5 with Ilya Lyubushkin, he does not have to worry about staying home and really playing a lot of defense. And that's not to say that he doesn't play defense. Obviously, if the play's coming back the other way, he's going to get back. But he's got that confidence and the freedom to be able to carry the puck on his own and make his own plays, because he knows Lyubushkin's going to be back there and he's got him covered. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of it. And I my favorite part of the Lyubushkin acquisition is the fact that everybody in Leafs media seemed to be convinced that to trade Nick Ritchie, you were going to have to give up a second round pick. And it was going to be one of those Patrick Marleau style deals where you have to pay to get rid of somebody. And in a sense they did, but getting Lyubushkin back in return, like in at that point, you're basically talking about getting Lyubushkin for a second round pick. And in that sense, that's a deal I'm more than happy to make, because you can see the impact that he's made on the Leafs and for their defensive core over the past 2 months or whatever it's been since they acquired him. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of the acquisition. I still need to see some more out of Giordano and Blackwell before I say he's better than both of them, or at least the acquisition was better, but he's definitely in my good books right now.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't think he's necessarily a better player than maybe like a Giordano, but what he brings to the lineup is exactly what they've been like really looking for, outside of maybe, I would say, earlier Jake Muzzin, where, you know, he was easily one of their most impactful defenders, and he's been hurt in the last two playoffs for them. But I just think there was always this talk about, you got to get a top four right-hand shot defenseman who does this, 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 and this. You just needed a guy who was physical and just gave a balance on the back end, because you have guys like Morgan Rielly and you've got Rasmus Sandin. And I think TJ Brody was also, like, a couple years ago was an absolute steal of a signing for the Sheldon Keefe and Dubas and those guys. And he's been great, but now you get to take Brody off that line. Lyubushkin fits so well with Rielly. The acquisition too of Giordano and Blackwell, and the fact that not only did Kyle Dubas not have to give up a first round pick, he also was able to get a bottom six forward in Colin Blackwell, who has fit in very well and has shown that he is, the size thing doesn't matter. He's what, 5'8", 5'9", but he's 5'9". Physical. Yep. He is hardworking. He's tough along the boards, and he has also made an impact, the impact that you want from a bottom six forward. And he's kind of one of those guys where you look and you can't really take him out of the lineup come playoff time, because I think he's been that impactful.
No, absolutely. And I think Blackwell in his first game at the Leafs led their forwards in hits. Like, I'm so over even entertaining people who try to use the argument of, oh, he's too small to play and stuff. Like, I don't, at that point, you just cut the conversation.
You didn't watch the game. Like, okay. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't watch the game, and you haven't paid attention to players in the past decade who are 5'9" or 5'8", et cetera, but can throw the body. Like, either way, I think Blackwell's definitely at a point where you can't really take him out of the lineup. And I don't know, I can't remember who said it. It may have been Keefe himself, but it was somebody within the organization. They were saying that Blackwell, as much as he's looked great right now, like, there's definitely an opportunity for him to move up in the lineup. It may have been the game when he was scratched against the Jets so that they could get both Spezza and Simmons into the lineup, since it was, the way that events went back in December when they played in Winnipeg. But yeah, I think Blackwell's going to get a bigger opportunity. He's a guy I could see slotting into the top six, even playing alongside Tavares here and there. I don't know if I'd make him the permanent second line winger, but I think he could definitely get a look there and at the very least hold his own.
Yeah, and you know, and you've got guys like Andre Kasha who are still out that could come back for the postseason as well. And you start trying to figure out there's got to be an odd man out at some point too. But before I talk about playoffs and matchups and any of that, I want to revert back to your comment that you made about Sheldon Keefe making the decision to scratch Ilya Lyubushkin and throw in Justin Hall into the game against Florida Panthers on a back-to-back on the road where you want that physical presence. I came on this show last week right after that game and said I think that was one of the worst moves that he could have made. And I don't know what he saw and what he thought he was doing. Cause I just, as soon as Lyubushkin came into the lineup, my argument would have been to not take out, to leave Liljegren Giordano because one, their analytical numbers are ridiculous. And I just think you got to try it. And I think that's what Keith was doing is he's trying all the different lineup combinations, but I'm waiting for him to not play Justin Hall in a game. And like Justin Hall's looked good with TJ Brody and Brody does that with everybody, but I want to get your thoughts on that decision. Obviously, you weren't a fan of it too. What would be your ideal defensive pairings for the Leafs moving forward, heading into the playoffs?
So I've thought a little bit about this. And in terms of if we're going for a game one lineup where everybody's healthy,
yeah.
I think as of right now, the pairings you got to go with are Morgan Rielly, Ilya Lyubushkin. I think you got to go Muzzin and Brody. And then I think you got to go Gio and Liljegren. And truth be told, if you asked me 2 months ago, if we would be sitting here talking about scratching Rasmus Sandin and making him the seventh defenseman for the playoffs, I would have laughed in your face. But at this point, with the defensive depth the Leafs have, I don't think they really have an option. And not only the defensive depth the Leafs have, but I think Lilligren's emergence alongside Giordano. Like, don't get me wrong. The Leafs traded for Giordano. I was sitting here like tooting the horn of Gio and Brody are reunited again. We're going to be our second pairing. And this is going to be the best thing in the world. They're going to be reunited. And at this point, I don't even want him to go with Brody because the way I see it, Brody is one of those players who, like you said, he makes everybody he plays with look good. And that's why I've got him with Jake Muzzin, because I feel like Muzzin, I'm not convinced that he just forgot how to play hockey this year. I don't think that's the case at all. I think I saw someone call the Muzzin Hall pairing just an overbearing amount of toxic chemistry. And I think that's the best way to put it, because I don't think Hall is as bad as he looks when he's with Muzzin. And I don't think Muzzin's as bad as he looks when he's with Hall. I think those two just for whatever reason can't play together.
They just cancel each other out almost.
No, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Like we've seen Muzzin play alongside other guys and look fine. Like I remember, I want to say it was a game towards the end of October, and they were trying Morgan Rielly on the top pairing with Travis Dermott with him on the top pairing. And however that pairing went, I don't know, but they had Muzzin with Brody on the second pairing. And that was one of Muzzin's better games of the season. I think it was against Detroit. I think at this point, you know, the Leafs, when you consider how many players they brought in at the deadline, I think one of the, and not even just the players they brought in at the deadline, when you see the players that they're getting back and stuff, I think something that could be just as good as a deadline acquisition is for them to get a healthy and able Jake Muzzin at his full potential for the playoffs. And I think the best way to do that is by playing him with TJ Brody, because that gives them the most insurance. Brody's a little bit more mobile of a player. I saw some people suggesting putting Muzzin with Lyubushkin. And while I think that pairing would be a lot of fun because, you know, the bodies would be flying, I think at the same time, those two guys together are a little bit slow for my liking. I'd like to see each of them have a puck mover. So I think Brody's mobile enough that he can play that puck mover role and also get back and, you know, cover his defensive assignments. So I would like to see Gio and Liljegren together, because what he's been able to do for Liljegren has been insane. And another counterpoint that I see a lot of people saying to those pairings, because I tweeted them a couple, like a week ago, and I had a bunch of people saying, well, why would you put Gio and Liljegren on the third pairing, give them third pairing minutes? And that's not at all what I'm thinking they should do. If they go with the pairings that I just suggested right there, I think that they should be splitting the assignments as about close as even as you can get. I think Muzzin and Brody would be great for taking on a lot of the D zone assignments. And then I think you've got a bit of a hybrid in both Gio and Liljegren and Morgan Rielly and Lyubushkin. So Yeah, I think it's also one of those things where, you know, if Liljegren has a bit of a tough go in the playoffs or whatever, or he has a bad game here, then you can bring in Hall again, or you can bring in Rasmus Sandin. And I think that's that last spot on the defensive core still can kind of be up for grabs in the playoffs, because if, you know, if something doesn't work, you're going to want to change it up. And I feel like it's inevitable that one of those defensemen is going to get hurt in the playoffs. I just, based on the way the past years have gone, it happened to Muzzin twice, happened to Liljegren earlier this season, happened to Sandin earlier this season. I just, you know, the way that playoffs ramp up and, you know, the calls pretty much revert to zero. I feel like it's inevitable one of those guys will get hurt. So I don't think these pairings will be set in stone, but that is definitely what I want to see him start with, because I think that when those six guys are out on the ice and with the guys that they're playing with, there's not a single pairing I don't feel confident watching on the ice or don't feel comfortable defending a lead.
No, and that was the comment I was waiting for you to say, is that it doesn't matter. When I remember there was a time when Dermott and Hall were a pairing, I think a couple of years ago, and every time they hit the ice, you just tense up a little bit because you know that there's a mistake bound to happen at some point. It was similar. I think Jake Gardner was paired at one point. I don't even know if it was with Morgan Rielly or not, but this was back in 2013, and you just like, you cringed a little bit because you knew there was a very decent possibility of a mistake happening. I don't see it with Riley Labushkin, because I think Labushkin, there was a play, I don't know if you remember this, it was against Tampa Bay. The game was tied at one. Labushkin starts at the blue line. He steps up to the red line. It's on Nikita Kucherov, go to throw a hit. Kucherov throws the puck all the way across the ice. The Leafs pick it up. It's Morgan Rielly who picks it up, sends it over to Bunting, to Matthews. He scores. That's the kind of impact that I think Labushkin brings that I don't know if any other defender brings, because they make you second guess yourself. And when you put Hall there, Hall doesn't step up, make that play. Tampa gets into the zone. God knows what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to your point about, you know, look at defensive pairings the Leafs have had in the past. Do you remember what their pairings were for game five against Columbus?
Well, Muzzin was out.
Yes.
So it was Brody wasn't here yet.
Nope.
Was it? It wasn't Hainsey, was it?
No.
Ron Hainsey wasn't there anymore at this point.
Yeah, he was gone by then.
No, hit me. What were they?
So it was Riley Ceci.
Oh my God, Ceci.
Yeah. Just in case you forgot about that pairing. Riley Ceci. Oh my God. And then it was Dermott Hall. And then it was Marinson Berry. The Leafs went into game five against Columbus with that defensive core. Like, it just, even, you know, even last year when they still, you know, they had Dermott there, and they were still, I think they had Bogle last year too. So that my point's a little bit irrelevant, but even last year there were some lapses, but the addition of TJ Brody to this defensive core has made such an impact in so many ways. I feel like the entire defensive core is more stable than it had been at any point during my time watching the Leafs, which is since like 2005. So
yeah.
Basically, all I have to say is, if you have any issues with the Leafs defensive core right now, just go back and look at that game. It's like things could be a lot worse.
As soon as you said Dermott Hall on the second pairing, that's where, and then you had probably one of the slowest D pairings on the third pair with Marinchen Berry. And if, I know a lot of people are like, Barry's not more of an offensive minded guy. I remember, I don't know if he was playing hurt, but I remember he got beat flat out by rookie Liam Foudy. Yep. He was a fast player, but he got beat out after having a step, and he had about a 3 or 4 foot gap on him, and Foudy closed the gap off. And I believe they ended up going on to score a goal there, but I just remember
they did. But the thing I remember more about that goal was the fact that Freddie Anderson even let it in. Cause I remember it was that horrible, horrible goal angle line, and it somehow squeaked in. Oh, geez.
The ghost of Freddie Anderson. Well, at the least, luckily they don't have that this year. They're going to hopefully be going in with a healthy Jack Campbell. As of today, as we're recording this podcast, it would be Toronto, Tampa Bay, which is wild because Toronto would have home ice advantage, which 2 weeks ago, Tampa was where Toronto is. And now things have changed. It could change tomorrow, next week, whatever the case may be. If you've got a pick between, I will go Tampa, I don't think Florida's going to happen, because I think Toronto's either too solidified in that spot now, but let's just throw it in there for the sake of it. If it's Toronto versus Boston, Tampa, or Florida, let's say, who are you taking? For me, I don't care.
That's a
At this point,
I don't care. I don't care either. Like I said to you before we started recording, the only team I don't want the Leafs to play in the playoffs is themselves.
Yeah.
Because we've seen over these past 2 weeks that the Leafs are more than capable of hanging out with the big dogs in the division. And it's just a matter of whether or not they want to translate that game to the playoffs and show up.
They've gone 3-0-1 over those three teams over the last four games. The only loss was that 7-6 loss, yep, which was on the road off a back-to-back with your technically third string goaltender who got hurt.
Yeah. So here's an interesting stat for you on top of that. The Leafs are 5-0-1 against Tampa, Boston, and Florida this year. They're 4-5-0 against Montreal, Buffalo, Ottawa. Just because, whatever, I guess parody. That makes sense. Yeah. But yeah, so to your point, yes, I am in the same boat as you. I don't care who they get because, like I said, they can beat anyone. It's just a matter of whether or not they beat themselves. But if I had to pick one between those three, I think the obvious answer is Boston because, you know, it would just be poetic. It would be, how poetic would it be for the Leafs to finally end their first round playoff drought by beating the team that ensured that this drought kept going so many times, 2013, 2018, 2019. Honestly, like the Boston Bruins are a ghost. Like do you remember that quote from All or Nothing, the documentary, when Paul McLean was like, they got demons everywhere. They got demons under their bed, in their heads. That's Boston. That's Boston with this team. They live rent free in the Leafs' heads, and I think it would just be a perfect way to end the drought if they were to go out there and beat Boston, finally get over the hump. And on top of that, I also think that Tuukka Rask not being there is going to have a bigger impact in the playoffs than some people might think.
Huge impact. I think David Krejci is even more important.
Oh, David, that's true. Actually, I didn't even consider that Krejci was.
He is a Leaf killer for as long as I can remember. It was when they played Boston. So 3 years ago, there was a stat that in David Krejci's three playoff series against Toronto, it was like 20 games or something like that, he had 30 something points.
Yeah.
Like he annihilated Toronto. And I think that not having that second line center on top of Toronto, hopefully having a healthy Matthews and Tavares up the middle, that's the difference maker for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Jeremy Swayman has been great this year. And Linus Ullmark, we've seen what he's been able to do. And both of those guys can get hot, but neither of those guys are Tuukka Rask. And I found that's been one thing that the Leafs have really, really had issues with in the past, on top of the obvious blowing leads and, you know, going out there and taking their foot off the gas too early, et cetera, all the classic Leaf demons. The one thing they've always really had trouble with is running into hot goalies. And, you know, Sergei Bobrovsky, as much as the Leafs made him look foolish in that game last week, and as much as, you know, he's been up and down this year, he could very well turn into hot Sergei Bobrovsky. And that's not a goalie that I want to face in the playoffs. And same with Andre Vasilevsky. We know Andre Vasilevsky and what he's capable of. So yeah, between those three teams, I'd probably go Boston, but in the end, I really don't care. All I care is that the Leafs show up and give 100% every single night, because if they don't do that, then we'll be sitting here having the exact same conversation again of what went wrong and what do you improve and how do you approach the offseason, etc. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to have that conversation anymore. I don't think the Leafs want to have that conversation. I don't think the media does, depending on who you speak to anyways. But as of right now, yeah, those three teams, I don't really care who they play. Just don't play yourselves.
The one thing I will say, and I've said this a couple times here on the show, is I don't fear Bobrovsky as much as you. And I just pulled up his stats just to check. Lifetime playoff goals against average, 3.24. Lifetime save percentage, 0.899. I don't buy him in the playoffs. I don't.
Okay, bring on Florida then. Never mind.
I don't mind. I don't mind Florida. The team I'm scared of is Tampa. Because Tampa, turn it on come postseason, and Brayden Point's an absolute animal. And this happens.
You just know that Brandon Hagel will be a Leaf killer as well. And then there will be all the headlines. Oh, the Leafs had two first round picks to play with, and they didn't spend it on Hagel. And look how it turned out for them. Like,
and they have one goal in like 18 games since they've acquired him too.
Yep.
And then come postseason, if they played, he'd have like six goals in seven games or something stupid.
Yep, that's
like
how it goes every single time.
My gosh. Well, I'm looking forward to one that ran to the regular season, seeing where Austin Matthews finishes with. I'm excited to see who they end up matching up with. Regardless of who it is, it's going to be a great series. Who knows if this is the year? I mean, I'll ask you, I guess, the final question here, because this is always the question that gets asked. from what you've seen this year and in past years before, what makes this year different for the Leafs?
I think their special teams, for one, I feel confident in both their penalty kill and their power play, which, you know, their penalty kill was solid. Their penalty kill wasn't actually that good last year. It started off all right, but it ended up towards the end of the season, it really started to fall apart. And on top of that, you know, the Leafs power play was so hot and cold last year. They had times when they would, like, I think in the first month, they were pretty much a guaranteed goal every time they got a power play. And then they just could not figure it out for the rest of the year. So,
because they had that stretch, right, where they didn't score for like 30 opportunities or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Start of March to the middle of March, they didn't score any goals.
Yeah.
So I would say their special teams is definitely a bigger one. And also their depth. Like, I think this year you've got probably 14 or 15 forwards that you could get away with icing in the lineup, and you've got 8 defensemen you can get away with icing in the lineup. I think the only thing that's different in a negative way is there's less stability in the crease. And say what you want about Freddie Anderson, but at least you knew that he was your guy going into the playoffs. Jack Campbell, I mean, credit where it's due, he's looked a lot better since coming back from his injury. I think he still had a couple of shaky starts here and there, but for the most part, he's been solid, and he's been better than the Jack Campbell we saw from January and February. So I think the goaltending is different. The goaltending is a bit of a question mark heading into the playoffs, but in terms of the positives, I think their depth is way better. And I think, their depth is better. Their special teams are better. And I also just think there's a little bit more of a mentality change around them this year. Cause like you said, we're seeing guys like Mitch Marner, you know, throw his body a little more. We're seeing, you know, Leafs like push the limits a little bit, get into the scrums after the whistle. You've seen the impact that guys like Ilya Lyubushkin have had on the defensive core and on the team, just by being there. And yeah. So all those reasons I would say are reasons to believe that this team might be different, but I don't know, man. I said this last year too. I literally predicted the Leafs to go all the way last year because I said this is literally the easiest path that they could possibly pave themselves to the playoffs. And they went and they just did the exact opposite. So I'm not believing anything until I see it. But I do think that roster-wise, I think that this is their best chance they've had in a long time.
A lot of cautious optimism, what I'm hearing, which I'm the same way. I have all my friends are the same way as well. And, you know, it's been 04, right? We're coming up on the 20-year mark that they've won a series, let alone gone anywhere. And like, it hurts just as much saying it, but one thing that you said that I do kind of feel a little okay about is the fact that what's the record? 5-0-1 against those top three beasts in the Atlantic and 4-5 and whatever against every other team. So if there's any indication, it's that when the games are up there, they can play up to their competition. And listen, here's hoping we get a chance to talk again in the second round and maybe that they're playing at this point. Alex, thank you again for joining me here on the podcast. Appreciate it. Go follow him at A Hobson Media on Twitter. Alex Hobson, he's the morning show host producer for the radio station in Niagara, News Talk 610. He's also the co-host of Sticks in the Six podcast and a writer for the Hockey Writers for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it. And hope we can have this discussion again in round two.
Once again, a huge thank you to Alex Hobson from the Hockey Writers covering the Toronto Maple Leafs, the co-host of Sticks in the Six podcast, and the producer of News Talk 610 Niagara. Make sure you give him a follow as well online. Alex Hobson, Twitter, Instagram. Follow his articles at the Hockey Writers as well. He is fantastic. I'm sure I'll be bringing him on here more often than not. I'm sorry it took so long to bring a guest back onto the show. I just shot him a message on Twitter. I've loved what he's been doing. He came on. He's got great insight. I think him and I also have similar ideas as to what's going on with that team. But nevertheless, thank you to him. Thank you to everybody who listened in. That is it for the show today. Enjoy the final stretch of the season. I believe next week we come on and there's only two or three weeks left in the season before playoffs. So we'll have a better idea of the playoff picture as well. Congratulations to all the teams that have qualified for the postseason. I'm sure there's more games in the Atlantic tonight. So Tampa and I think Boston could potentially clinch, but it's a foregone conclusion for mostly the teams in the East. The West, it's still kind of wide open. Super excited about that. I've got a brand new article on the Hockey Writers for the Canucks talking about the fact of the record without Brock Besser, who's out for, I think, the remainder of the season with an upper body injury. I should have also brought this up a little earlier, too, so I'm going to quickly sneak this in. Drew Doughty Wrist surgery, out for the remainder of the season. He's been out since March 7th. The Kings have lost three straight games. The Kings might slowly start to falter back. Canucks could sneak in. And I've actually got a piece going on right now, too, about how Vancouver could potentially sneak into the postseason with some help from a couple teams and the injury bug hitting them. So that's going to be coming up later on. Listen, enjoy. We'll see you next Tuesday. Until then, that's a wrap.